The 57th Wing is one of the largest and most diverse wings in the United States Air Force. It includes, among many missions and units, the Air Force Weapons School, the 414th Combat Training Squadron that runs the Red Flag exercises, the world's best and most realistic air, space, and cyber exercise, the 57th Adversary Tactics Group that provides air defense, and information aggressors to improve realism of training events and exercises, the Air Force Advanced Maintenance and Munitions Operations School, or AMOS, the 561st Joint Tactics Squadron that publishes Air Force and Joint Tactics Techniques and Procedures Manuals, and the world-famous United States Air Force Air Demonstration Squadron, better known around the world as the Thunderbirds. My guest today was a graduate of the A-10 Weapons School course. He was an instructor and eventually became the commander of the A-10 Squadron at the Weapons School. He was also the commandant of the Weapons School and is now the 57th Wing Commander, Brigadier General Michael Johnny Bravo Drowley. General Drowley is an inspirational leader, and he's a combat hero. He's passionate about the mission, the people, and the stories of Nellis Air Force Base. He's here to talk about Nellis today and its importance to the Air Force and the United States military as a whole. This is the Air-Minded Podcast, Nellis Season. Welcome back, listeners. This is the Air-Minded Guerrilla, Tyson Wetzel, coming back after an extended hiatus, but I'm back in the podcasting game with a guest that I've really been excited to have on the podcast and really excited to get back into the Nellis season. So today we're going to be talking about contemporary Nellis Air Force Base with one of the guests that I most desired to get on this podcast, Brigadier General Michael Johnny Bravo Drowley, the current commander of the 57th Wing at Nellis. I've known General Drowley for probably about a decade. He's a tactical expert in the A-10. He's passionate about close air support, but more than that, he's a natural leader. You can't help but want to run through a wall for this guy. He's an A-10 pilot, like I said, by trade. He graduated the U.S. Air Force Weapons School in 2002, and within a couple of months of that, he was leading attack pilots and high-threat close air support or CAS missions within Afghanistan. A year after that, he's leading A-10s into Iraq on the first night of Iraqi freedom. He's got more than 200 combat hours among his 2,500 flying hours. He was awarded 2 Distinguished Flying Crosses with Valor. That's the nation's highest award for extraordinary aerial achievement. He's a very impressive A-10 pilot, but more than that, like I said, he's a leader. He's commanded an Air Force Academy Cadet Squadron, the 66th Weapons Squadron. That's the A-10 Squadron at the Air Force Weapons School. He eventually was the commandant of the Weapons School, so that he was in charge of every squadron, every combat capability and flying platform at the Weapons School. And then before his current job, he commanded the 355th Wing at Davis-Monthan. And then, like I said, now the 57th Wing Commander. So you can see he's had multiple assignments at Nellis. There's nobody that knows current-day Nellis Air Force Base better than General Drowley. He was very generous with his time. I had an hour to go over all the things that his wing does. It's only really time to hit the high points. I talked about some of the things that he's leading in his position right now. I talked about some of the combat capabilities, some of the unknown stories at Nellis, and why Nellis is so important to the way the Air Force and truly the Joint Force fights. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I really enjoyed having it. I do mention briefly to him that I really hope that I get the chance to bring him back on to talk some A-10 war stories, because he's got some great ones. But with that said, let's talk Nellis Air Force Base, and let's hear from General Johnny Bravo Drowley. I hope you enjoy. My guest today is the 57th Wing Commander, Brigadier General Michael Johnny Bravo Drowley. I talked about his everything he's done in the intro, but just a couple of things that are pertinent today. He spent a lot of time at Nellis Air Force Base, a graduate of the A-10 Weapons School in 2002, an instructor from 04 to 07 back in 2010 to 12, and then was commander of the A-10 Squadron at the Weapons School, the 66th Weapons Squadron. Came back just a few years later from 2015 to 2017, was the commandant of the Air Force Weapons School, and about the last year or so, since August of 20, the 57th Wing Commander. And also, important to me, one of the earliest supporters of this podcast, when I announced that I was doing it, he reached out to me on social media. It is really an honor to be able to have General Drowley here. So, sir, welcome to the Air-Minded Podcast, and thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. Like you said, biggest fan, and I'm really glad I get to be a part of this.
All right. So one of the first questions I always ask is what you're drinking today. It is 1 o'clock your time. You're at work. I'm going to spare you.
and just say that we're both drinking water today. So anyways, with that said, the other question that I like to start with is your Air Force origin story. You weren't born as a Brigadier General. How did you get to be where you are today?
Yeah, so I'm an Air Force brat, kind of grew up in the Air Force. My old man was a 1971 graduate from the Air Force Academy, fighter pilot, flew F-4s, O-2s, F-15s. So I graduated from high school in Alamogordo, New Mexico, where Holloman Air Force Base is located. He was with the 8th at the time, and then went off to the Air Force Academy, prep school, followed by the Air Force Academy, and graduated in 1996. Was lucky enough to get into pilot training. I went down to JSUPT at Pensacola as part of one of the initial exchange programs that they were running at the time. I think that's evolved since then. And then was lucky enough to select the A-10 out of there. And so and from there, just extremely lucky with great leaders and great mentors who coached me along the way. And but that was really, it was the bug that bit me when I was a kiddo. We had two assignments at Holloman Air Force Base. And during the first one, my dad was doing a flyby for the Space Hall of Fame. He was part of a four ship. And so we got up on the roof of the house because their route was kind of taking them near our neighborhood. And I remember looking up at the four ship flying by and thinking to myself, man, I would love to do that someday. It was amazing. So the bug kind of bit me then and then stuck with me ever since.
Wow. Did not know that your father was a grad. Reminds me, we had General Walters come in a few years ago when I was back at Nellis, and he talked about how his father was a grad and got him started. He's obviously done pretty well for himself. There's a lot there. I would love at some point to talk about your A-10 days, just to get ready for this interview. I watched for, I don't know, the half dozenth time your TED Talk from, I don't know, a decade ago. I'm going to put that in the podcast liner notes. Absolutely love it. And your comment about your hair still gets me every time. It was awesome.
Thanks.
But really want to focus on Nellis. So let's talk about your Nellis origin story. Already went through it. This has got to be, including being a student, what, your fourth or fifth time at Nellis. When I think, and this episode is going to be titled Nellis Today, when I think of Nellis, I definitely think of you. So how did you, I guess, get to Nellis initially in 02? And you talked about how you caught the Air Force bug. Is that kind of how you caught the Nellis bug, was going through school, or where did that start?
Yeah, I remember my first assignment was to Osan in Korea. And in standard, it was a huge lieutenant protection agency there. It was just about 32 lieutenants that showed up because they were clearing the UPT backlog. And so as they were assigning duties and who was going to be working in what shop, and you're getting the tour of the squadron. I remember I went back to the vault. Spam Milam was the weapons officer at the time, who was later an instructor at the weapons school when I was a student. And I remember him giving the spiel of, hey, if you want to learn about scheduling, you go to this office. If you want to learn about stand eval, you go to this office. If you want to learn how to break things and be the best that you can at your trade craft, you come talk to me. And that was kind of the first introduction of, like, I want to be that. Like, I want to evolve into that at some point if I'm able to do it. And so that was kind of the initial hook. After Osan, I went to Davis-Monthan, and there you're really introduced to how it's much more than that. It's not just how are you instructing the rest of the squadron. It's not just how are you creating a Top Gun program for weapons delivery. It's really about how do you ensure everybody's ready. And then from the squadron level up, like, how are you helping the rest of the team? And so I wanted to compete for the weapons school, and there was a lot of, hey, is the timing right? I was at Davis-Monthan for a relatively short time. And so I got to come out and do a WIC support, and some of the instructors were at the weapons school at the time. I was like, yeah, I don't know if I'm quite ready yet as an instructor. You know, maybe I need to develop more. Maybe I need to pay back a little bit more to the squadron. And that was the first time I heard the following, which was the, hey, this is a lot of what's affecting you, and it's not about you. Like, we're telling you it's time to go to the weapons school because we need you. We need you to put the patch on and go fight some battles and take care of the team. And that was really, I had really been raised in that from a close air support. It's not about you. But now it was Air Force wide when it came to the weapons school. And so that really resonated with me. And so, like you mentioned, in O2 Alpha, got to come out and be a student at the weapons school. And you really, it for me, it was a life-changing experience. I'm a blubbering idiot when it comes to the weapons school because you think differently. You become a critical thinker. It's about your leadership. You learn about everybody's capabilities. And so it was really a defining moment for me, the ability to not only get into the weapons school, but participate in it. And I remember every day I was at the weapons school, I was like, if I were to wash out tomorrow, I'm a better person for having been in here. And and I can't pay back enough from what I've received from this institution. But I was lucky enough to graduate. And then kind of like you heard from the tech talk, three days later, I was deploying to Afghanistan and then spent some time over there. And then in the downtime as a tier one weapons officer, recalled off my leave to go get ready for Operation Iraqi Freedom. And that's really how I spent my 2 years as a tier one patch, was during OEF and OIF.
Yeah, pretty amazing. And what you said there that really kind of struck with me of interest is, you know, it's not about you, it's what you can do for the community, and the fact that within the next, you know, 12 to 18 months, leading other attack pilots, being mission commander in Afghanistan and Iraq, in some pretty hairy situations. And it's amazing what that school does for you. I like to think I'm about as passionate about the weapons school as you can get. And so it is great talking about it. So obviously you had the best job in the Air Force, being the weapons school commandant. Now you may even have a better job, which is to be the 57th Wing Commander. Let me just start with the question that I've asked my other guests this season. What makes the Nellis special? I've heard people, I've heard integration, realism of training. There's a lot of things that make Nellis special. What do you think makes Nellis different and special?
Yeah, it really is all those things. It is the magic or the secret sauce, if you will, that is at this place. Like if you go to other bases, they have excellence. Like you go down to over to Langley, where the specialty is air dominance, or you go down to Davis-Monthan and it's a focus on attack and rescue. Here you have all of this expertise, all of these capabilities in one location where you can really come together and figure out, okay, what can we do to either solve this problem or improve things and make sure everybody's ready for whatever that potential conflicts on the horizon may be. And that's really what is just baked into the culture here, is we are going to keep improving. We're going to keep evolving. And you use the weapons school as an example. When I came through in O2 Alpha, we had 52 graduates within my class. You look at the weapons school today, it's close to 130 graduates. And that's in the weapons school outright. And then there's several advanced instructor courses for our enlisted where they can become tactical experts within their expertise areas. And so it's that constant improvement, that constant evolving of what can we do to ensure we're more lethal, we're more ready, we're better leaders to be able to handle the challenges that we have on the horizon. And so to me, that's what really makes this place incredible, is if you have a command and control question or how can we better do this, you walk down the hallway and there's the top 1% in the Air Force there working on it. If you're like, hey, let's try and figure out a way that we can improve a tactic or something along those lines. Again, you've got the team here to be able to do those. And then you have the airspace, you've got the scrimmage team with the aggressors. So this is the one place where all those things come together. And within the culture, everybody, they don't think the same way, but they believe in the same things. And that's that purpose of how do we make sure the team is ready? And we're helping everybody do that.
What you hit on many, many things that I want to cover. Let me just start kind of big picture. As a commander of the 57th Wing, it's got to be the most diverse wing in the Air Force, with the weapons school, the aggressors you hit on, red flag, you support green flag, which supports Army training at the National Training Center, the Thunderbirds, which I have not been talking about enough this season, the advanced maintenance and munitions operations school. It may be easier to say what the 57th Wing doesn't do, but just big picture, first off, I don't know how you get your arms around everything that you need to do as the commander, but let's just kind of try to put a fine point on it. What does the 57th Wing provide to the Air Force in terms of its combat capability? What does the 57th Wing bring to the fight?
Yeah, we really are I don't want to call it mini, but a small scale Air Force, Space Force, Cyber Force all together that provides high-end training to get after those problem sets and ensure the force is ready by improving tactics, ensuring the force is trained. And so it's really that what I would call from tonight to about the 3-year time horizon that we're focused on. Once you're outside of 3 years, then it becomes in that test, the capability lane of emerging technology and requirements. But for us, it is whether it's red flag in the first 10 combat sorties that we're flying, whether it's the weapon school and producing instructors of tactics that can go out to their squadrons and proliferate that knowledge. We're really concerned about that high-end fight and the most realistic training that we can provide. And that's what the weapon school provides. That's what the red flag provides from an air dominance standpoint. That's what green flag provides from a land component integration standpoint. AMOS on not only our maintenance, but our logistics and our capabilities to provide those things. And then the Thunderbirds are really our ability to go out and recruit and inspire through the excellence that they provide day in and day out and the precision and the discipline associated with that. So we're kind of a mini Air Force here to be able to take that strategic direction from PACAF and USAFE and ACC and say, okay, what are the problems out there and how do we ensure that any airman, you know, within the Air Force that comes through our gate is able to look at themselves in the mirror and go, I'm ready for this challenge. Like I'm prepared for it based off the training that they received here.
Yeah. Love Nellis, love the 57th wing. There's so much there to talk about. So I'm going to try to take each component or a few of them individually. I wanted to start with the weapon school. Obviously you and I could spend more time than we've got here just to talk about why we love the weapon school. And hopefully I'll see you out there in a month at patch night and we can catch up a little bit more about it. But let's just talk about, you kind of already talked about why the weapon school is important and just some of the improvement or the increase in scope from 52 or 3 grads, you said, to 130 plus the enlisted courses, constant improvement. What's next for the weapon school? Is it more jointness? Is it more integration of space and cyber? Where is the weapon school going in the future?
Yeah, I do think it's some of those things. And we're really trying to wrap our arms around what is that evolution of strategy look like for the weapons school right now. So we've got some great joint integration, whether it is from our special ops support that we get during our weapons school integration phase. Our FA-18 Growlers come out from Top Gun, and they integrate into WISNT as well. It's part of their culmination exercise. We also get the Army with Patriot and a few other capabilities that come out. And so we've got some good joint integration that's there. But when you look at the strategic roadmap of force design for the Air Force with the B-21, KC-46, ABMS for the Air Battle Management System, possibly Wedgetail, the 4+1 model of MDSs that we're looking at. To me, it comes down to how do we prioritize those core competencies of air dominance, global precision attack, rapid mobility, and then C2ISR, and still ensure that we are providing expertise in those areas. And so to us, you know, does that become mission specific WICs? Is it now we have those capabilities and we learn how to best integrate them? And so that's what we're looking at as we continue to evolve is how do we take those key elements and those key ingredients and continue to improve and ensure that we're providing that training. And so we haven't got it quite figured out yet, but that's what the team is focused on as we look at the future. For right now, though, it really is when you look at the weapon school's timeline of 5.5 months, the first 3.5 to 4 months are how do I create an MDS expert that's able to be the premier instructor within their specialty? And then at that 4-month point, they become what I would call their tribe patch wearer, their MDS patch wearer, their mission patch wearer. And then the last month and a half, it's how do we make them an Air Force weapons officer, which is capable of being credible in the joint domain. They're able to plan. They're at the high end of the tactical, kind of mid-level of the operational. And we've made just incredible evolutions where that's concerned. I think one of the crowning achievements that I got to see last class was on one of our most challenging problem sets. The space student was up providing a plan on how the air domain was going to provide support to space and was speaking, you know, much like a fighter pilot would. And then the F-35 student that got up was talking about how the air domain was supporting things that were going on within the space and cyber domains. And you could have thought that they were a guardian. And, you know, that's the level of integration and expertise they're providing. And you know, I look back in it when I was a student at the weapons school, it was, hey, I'm just going to do my thing in my lane. And as long as I do that well, then hopefully it works out. The problem sets that we're going up against today, you can't do that anymore. You've got to be able to integrate and know exactly how all that comes together from a C2 perspective. And that's what the students are doing. And so as we look at how we evolve in the future, it's going to be with that in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly not the fighter weapon school not your father's fighter weapon school.
Yeah.
You mentioned WISINT, the weapon school integration phase. That is the last part of the course where you bring what are now the best A-10 pilots in the world, the best intelligence operators, the best whatever, you bring them all together to solve incredibly tough tactical problems. One of the things that I've noticed in my time deployed and talking to folks, whether it be supporting combat search and rescue or close air support or any of the other missions that we do, there's not much thrown at them in combat that they haven't seen at the weapon school. You've got a lot of combat hours. I'm guessing, especially the way that you're nodding your head, that you feel like the weapon school is training you so that even if we don't train everything that you'll see in combat, you know how to solve those problems. Would you say kind of that's what the weapon school is producing today?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both where we want to provide that level of realism. We want to provide that advanced threat replication and adversary support that we're going up against. So that way, when you do get into combat, you're like, hey, this is way easier than it was at the weapon school. At the same time, if we can't provide all those problem sets, at least we have a critical thinker that goes, you know what, I haven't seen this particular problem before, but I've got the skill set to be able to navigate it and lead my squadron or lead whatever level I'm at through it. And so that's the other aspect of it, where it's not particularly like, hey, I saw this exact same thing, but I can critically think through that. And I'll tell you that that's important right now because in looking at some of the potential scenarios that we have and some of the pacing challenges that are out there, being able to keep up with that from a training standpoint is becoming more and more challenging, which we're putting a high workload on our aggressors to be able to train, replicate, and instruct to some of those threat scenarios that are out there. And why one of our top priorities is the virtual training and synthetic environment to be able to continue to provide that high level of quality training that we get here.
Yeah. And that's always a tough one, especially our air crew wanting to be there and in the air, but there are some presentations that you just can't make happen in the air, and that's where you bring in the live virtual constructed environment, and you know, potentially that's where we go. So transitioning from the weapon school again, I would love to talk that all day, but let's talk a little bit about Red Flag. 21-3 just ended. Red Flag to me just morphs and changes so much and gets bigger and more important. I think about when I was a lieutenant and it was just, you know, it seemed like it's just a total rage fest to go out there, and there were good lessons learned, but it just seems like it has gotten better and better. So I guess, talk about 21-3 or what is the future of Red Flag and how is Red Flag bringing more combat capability to bear for the Air Force?
Yeah, so it has come a little bit at full circle where we're really trying to get back to the foundational Moody Suter principles that were provided, which was those first 10 combat sorties. And so we saw a little bit of an expansion where we were trying to make Red Flag, I think, all things to all participants. And what we have recentered towards is, again, how can we take the problem sets and the challenges either in the Europe theater or the Pacific theater and give that as 10 combat sorties to the participants in Red Flag. And so, you know, it's no longer going against the Kyoshins as our aggressor force. They're still out there. We're taking care of them as our bad guys. But how can we get more reflective problem sets that are associated with the three potential AORs that we may go to? Now, what has continued to evolve and what has continued to improve that we're going to maintain is, again, that level of integration between the space domain, the cyber domain, the kinetic and the non-kinetic effects. So it's not just a very fighter-centric role. It is, again, mobility. It is global strike. It is those other capabilities that now all come together to provide the effects that we're looking for. And we're going to continue that. And so we've been getting, again, great feedback from the training that the training audience gets, but we want to make sure that we're continuing to improve on that. So again, they're getting those first 10 combat sorties here on the Nellis range and not when the flag goes up.
So transitioning from Red Flag, I mean, it's still, I love that you brought up Moody Suter, that era of Nellis history, the early to mid 70s, as you get all of those really pissed off combat veterans from Vietnam, saying, you know, we're never going to allow the Air Force to send air crew unprepared to combat. And that led to so many changes. That's why I've been pretty clear. That's my favorite period of Air Force history. Mm-hmm. And I love to see how young majors and in some cases captains really pushed that kind of change, and especially with our chief now pushing us to be to accelerate change or lose, as he likes to say. It really feels like Nellis is kind of the epitome of what General Brown would advocate, and I'm sure that is something that you use in your leadership.
Yeah, that's been the gauntlet that's been thrown down, is how do we accelerate change or lose? And so the whole team here is focused on that. And to that point, that's where we want to really provide, whether it is through red flag, again, green flag, or the weapon school, those opportunities to say, hey, listen, we're going to give you the best feedback that we can. When you show up, we're going to take a look at your game plan. We're going to punish your mistakes. But we're also going to provide our feedback on, hey, here's what we see that works and wins. And here's great practices that you had. And how do we capture those and disseminate it? And we found the best way to do that is the bar napkin debrief, and just a very direct, like, here's how you did and here's how you performed. And that's really what we've tried to capture as far as an enduring process as we continue to provide those types of things. And so, like you said, I got to participate. It was two red flags ago. We had an A-10 unit come out and got to fly with that. And when our aggressors are flying, I get to jump in with them. And watching a team show up from the first couple sorties to the last couple sorties, even within those 2 to 3 weeks, you just see huge strides. And that is awesome. It means that it works. The model's sound.
And probably why we've been doing it since 1975 is that the model works. And it's a unique exercise around the world, really. And there's a reason why our allies and partners want to be a part of Red Flag to understand how we're going to be fighting the war of both today and the future. Mm-hmm. All right. Wanted to transition to the aggressors. It feels like, man, I just have to hit the wave tops on each of these. but the aggressors, really important. They're vital to what we do, whether it's supporting the weapons school, whether it's supporting Red Flag. And a lot of times we just think of the 64th aggressors, or back in the day, the 65th with those beautiful eagles. But there's the information aggressors, and then space aggressors, not under your domain. But why are the aggressors such a vital component of what the wing does?
Yeah, so when we look at those problem sets and those challenges that we're trying to replicate, they provide the most realistic and the most instantaneous feedback of how somebody's doing. There is nothing, I would say, more tangible than when you get killed in a red flag or a weapon school integration vol and have to tuck tail and head on home. And that is very tangible feedback on how your tactics were, how your execution was, how your game plan came together. And it's our aggressors, whether it's the information cyber aggressors or the 64th F-16 aggressors that we have that provide that. And then our air defense aggressor squadron that coordinates all of those entities together. And so they're critical for us. So again, that way we can put together a plan and they'll punish the mistakes and provide the feedback on how we did. And so they're great, unbelievably professional. And when you get to go out there and train against something like that, it's just a huge benefit and learning for the entire team.
Yeah. So when are we going to start seeing F-35 aggressors? And when is the 65th aggressor squadron going to re-stand up?
Yep. So we have a timeline for that. When we look at what it is that we're trying to provide as far as that high-end training, having F-35 aggressors be part of that and have a professionalized aggressor force, it's critical because they provide that capability that is very hard to emulate with any other type of capability that's out there. So we have a timeline to provide that. We're still in coordination and working what exactly that will look like as far as when we can unhurl the flag and start launching sorties out. Until then, we're using some of our capacity of F-35 sorties here to still give that look and still provide that level of training. But we've identified it as a requirement, and now we're working forward to stand in the 65th aggressors up so that way we can have that professionalized fifth generation adversary force to be able to fight against.
This further shows how Nellis continues to change and evolve and provide that realistic training that is necessary for our forces. So something that I really don't know a whole lot about, but very interested in, because we were not using Contract Red Air when I was there, is how are you all using Contract Red Air? What aircraft are flying? It must be not only cool to see some unique and different aircraft, but I'm guessing very important, especially as you're talking about the pace and the number of students that are going through things like the weapon score increasing. You've got to have just an insatiable demand for adversary platforms.
Yeah, insatiable demand is the right way to phrase that. We can't produce enough when you look at the 64th aggressors as far as the lines and the picture that we're going against. And so our contract ad air helps provide more of that capacity. And so when we look at some of the challenging problem sets that we're going to be going up against, we have to have both capacity and capability. And the contract ad air right now is giving us the capacity end of that. The 65th aggressors, and as we look at future contract ad air options, that's where we're trying to say, hey, capacity is good, but now we need to start looking at more and more capability, whether that's advanced radars, passive detection systems, and those kind of things, because again, those are the type of threats that we may be going up against. And so they provide a critical capability to ensure that we're going up against a robust force that can challenge us throughout the duration of a vol period. And that's what they give us. And they're an extremely professional team in providing that.
All right, sir. So in the position that you're sitting in as the 57th Wing Commander, lots of eminent Air Force leaders have sat in that chair before you, including a couple of chiefs of staff of the Air Force and General Jumper, General Mosley. I like to ask some of our leaders that are sitting in positions where they've had eminent leaders before them, is there somebody that you have read about or worked for or worked with that sat in that seat that you kind of emulate or really think a lot about as you're in this job?
Yeah, that you kind of picked a tougher question. There's been some all-stars that have, come through, like literal all-stars. And that's a toughie. I get to talk to General Jumper still. He's a senior mentor for the Thunderbirds, and he, still is completely engaged, provides great mentorship and coaching. When I look at, as you mentioned, I've had a few reps through the house here, and the wing commanders that I had each and every time, like, were unbelievable. Again, as far as learning leadership from General Darnell was the wing commander when I was a student. I get to talk to him from time to time with the Thunderbird connection. General Rue was the wing commander when I was here as an instructor, and I still get to see him. And so from each one, whether it was their operational, tactical, and strategic knowledge and just direction that they would provide to the hands-on leadership that they would give the entire team, it's just been phenomenal. So it's a tough problem set to try and identify one. The one thing that I do find that's interesting is that every 57th Wing Commander, whether it was General Short, General Lovett, General Moore, phenomenal one, General Novotny was just a really tough act to follow. They all had what I would call kind of their thing, whether it was navigating their way through sequestration, whether it was how do we bring on this new platform, and along with managing all the other things that go on here, like you identified, which is quite a bit. They also found a way to incorporate that in and see a vision of where Nellis needed to go to keep it moving in that direction to provide the high-end training that we provide here at the 57th Wing. So it's really tough to identify one. I would say that probably the most hands-on coaching and mentoring I've received lately was the ability to work for General Harigian when I was out at the AFSCME Chief of Staff. He's a Warriors General. Insight to be able to ask critical questions, focus on what I would say is that how do we affect the fight and do it from an air and space standpoint. I probably, of my little note taker book, took like three books worth of notes just watching him in action for the year that I was over there. So there's been no shortage of great examples out there, and I've been really lucky to be able to work with a lot of them.
Yeah. Typically, Air Force put some pretty smart folks in that seat to ensure the guidance of that wing. So just as a follow-up, you mentioned that each leader of the 57th, each commander of the 57th has kind of had their thing, their vision. It must be hard to believe already in your last year of that job. What is your vision? What do you want to get across the line for the next year for your replacement or set up your replacement?
Yeah, so I would say it's two things. One are those connections that we have with both USAFE and PACAF to say, hey, what are the things that keep you up at night and how can we work on them here? From a very tangible standpoint of, you know, the specificity of what it is that we need to train the force to. And so having that linkage, having that feedback loop, that command and feedback loop with those two entities, with AFSCENT, PACAF, and USAFE is huge. And so from an up and out standpoint, I would say that that's really, I would say, one of the primary centers of gravity that we have. The other one, kind of from the wing level down, is what does our roadmap to the future look like? I talked about how we're trying to take a look at the weapon school strategy. That goes across the board, whether it's Red Flag, the ops group, the aggressors, is really trying to map out infrastructure, requirements, capabilities that get us from the next 5 to 10 years. And if I can hand that off and say, here's the action item list to be able to execute this, then that's what I would call a success. So that's really where the bulk of our, I would say, brain bites are going right now, is how can we craft that and create that so that way there's an enduring flight path to be able to get us through the next 10 years.
I do think it's interesting that you talk about your up and out vision in talking to our components, our geographic components. And I'm guessing it's to ensure that you are providing the force that will fight their wars if they're required to. Yeah. And I think that's an important part of Nellis that sometimes we don't cover, is we don't do this training just to make kick-ass operators. It's really to meet warfighter demand and provide those airmen and guardians that need to do the job that are required in PACAF, USAFE, AFSCENT, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so there's a lot in the wing, and I'm sure that there are things that I've missed. So is there something, whether it's the Thunderbirds or the 561st Joint Tactics Squadron, what are maybe a story, a unit, organization that maybe I need to do a little bit deeper diving on and try to get on here to talk about a little bit more in detail?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, an evolving one, again, that's going through its own metamorphosis, what I would say to the next level is AMOS. And that's a great one to take a look at. So when you look at where that school has come from General Jumper's time in the seat to where we are today, it has provided levels of expertise when it comes to maintenance, munitions, and our logistics. And so it's going through an evolution right now, almost weapon school-esque, on how it is figuring out what its tier one requirements are, what do those patch wearers need to be ready for, whether it's ACE from an expeditionary standpoint, agile combat employment, logistics under fire, sustainment in the high-end fight, things that are very, very challenging. You know, I always say, hey, it's easy for me to come up with the how do we break things plan. It's another thing to logistically be able to support that. And that's really what they're doing. So they've become more integrated with the weapon school. We're going to continue that, as well as when we look at here's the tactics that we're providing or some of the operational command and control, they're the ones figuring out like, okay, how do we support that now? So that would be a great area to dig into, because they do some amazing work and they're in the middle of an evolution right now that's going to take them to the next level as well.
It makes me happy that I put this question down. Not at all what I anticipated that you would say, but I think that is really important. And I know there was sometimes they were a little bit made fun of here at Nellis as you know, trying to be like the weapons school, but it sounds like they're really developing their own tradition and being really important as the maintenance, logistics, munitions equivalent of the weapons school. So that is great. Something that I absolutely wasn't thinking about. That's awesome. Yeah. All right, let's just take a step back from Nellis, since you've got a lot of time in the Air Force. That's not my way of calling you old, but you've got some time in the Air Force, and obviously pretty passionate about our service and what we do in the profession that we've selected. So let's talk about is there a story outside of Nellis for the Air Minded that maybe we should be thinking about, or that you would like to get a little bit more word out about, or have that story told?
Well, I think where we are right now and where we need to go is from a standpoint of our airmen and our guardians that are out there are doing amazing things. When you look at the problem sets that we're going after and the things that we're asking them to do, I think it was General Welsh that used to say it all the time, was the problem with our service is we just make it look too easy, you know, where it's an easy button. And from a lot of the operations that we've supported over in the AFSCNT AOR, whether it was, you know, from combat operations all the way to our C-17s going in there and affecting the retrograde, there has been just no shortage of leadership and what I would call dynamic problem solving going on to get the job done. And so it seems on a daily basis, I get to hear about a patch wearer or a Nellis alumni that was faced with like an unsolvable problem that found out a way to get it done, or just a, hey, I'm not accepting the status quo anymore. I'm going to go shake things up. And so what's amazing to me about this place is when you look through its history all the way back from the Sierra Hotel timeframe, when, you know, Captain Jumper was here trying to help improve LGB tactics, to right now where we're looking at how do you automate artificial intelligence and those type of things to help us populate a data link. Like those type of initiatives and just, you know, the in willingness to say, I'm just accepting where we're at right now are the stories that I love to hear. And so we've got a ton of them out there. It's almost hard to wrap your arms around how much of that's going on. And where I always try and help out is highlight those type of things, because it's not easy and it's not magic, but it takes a lot of hard work from a lot of talented people to get the job done. And so I think wherever you go, those type of leaders are out there, and those were those stories are from. And so whether it's in PAC, AFU Safety, or AFSCNT right now, a lot of people are doing a lot of good work figuring out how are we going to solve these problems. And they're really, I mean, doing an amazing job of it. So I wish I could give you a specific vector or point out, but it really is. I'm eye-watered every day getting to hear the good work that our patch wearers and our Nellis alum are doing out there.
Now, a couple of things you said, I mean, you just kind of threw in there C-17. It is really important to talk about how Nellis isn't just the fighter world that we've always come to believe, or that there was the tradition of the base. I mean, you have mobility air forces, you have space and cyber, everything comes together to create the realistic environment that is helping to build the kind of warfighter that the service needs. I think that is really important. I also think about folks that graduated with me that just within a couple of years, they were out there planning, combat operations. I remember a couple of B1 students with me, or we instructed together. They're out there planning the first night of the Libya missions. And it's, you just never know where you're going to be put in your career. And I think Nellis really provides some of the tools that you need to be able to handle whatever that problem is going to be, because I think both of us and you in particular have been in that kind of situation, and I think that the skills from Nellis really help you get through those times.
Yeah, I would say that's probably some of the proudest moments I have, is when I hear about, like, in the in our movement out of Afghanistan, hearing our C-17 patch wearers planning that with our JTAC patch wearers providing command and control, and they were classmates, and the connection was there because of their shared experience here. And when you look at it going, that happened because of what they went through here for this 5.5 months that allowed them to lead, critically think, and then have the connections with each other. That to me is what it's all about.
Yeah. And that's actually one of the areas I'd like to look at in a little bit is talking about, is regardless of what you may think about the retrograde on the ground tactically, an unbelievable job. And especially what our service was able to do to get 123,000 or whatever people out in 10 or 11 days is just mind-boggling. And it was done not by people our age. It was by the younger folks that were on the ground figuring it out, making it happen without, just unbelievable stuff. And certainly made me proud to see what we were doing as a service. Okay, my last question, and I like to end on these, is since I read a ton of books, I read a ton of air-minded books. So I like to get the opportunity to see what other folks are reading or have read that have been influential. Is there an air-minded book recommendation? You can't use Sierra Hotel since you already use that. And that's my favorite book. It doesn't even need to be about Nellis, but is there a book that you would recommend both to myself and the listeners?
Boy, that again is a really tough one. I get a lot of my reading recommendations from you, but I always like the Vietnam era air power books, that go all the way from When Thunder Rolled by Ed Rasmus or 100 Mission North by Ken Bell. Those were, I would say, very impactful on me as I kind of looked at my trajectory and growing up. Right now I'm reading Overlord, which is the Elwood P. Quesada book on how he put together his tactical air corps. He's kind of considered the father of close air support, but at the same time had a problem set on how do you command and control these forces and innovative ways in being able to do that. And so I've read that for my thesis as kind of a quick read. Now I'm doing a little more deeper dive into that. And so that's a very good one. And then I'm also doing a reread of Colin Gray's Air Power for Strategic Effect. That's a deep one, but at the same time,
that's a slow read. I mean, you got to be there with the highlighter and the pen ready to really put some time into. Colin Gray can stretch it out. It's an incredibly important book. I'm with you.
Yeah. But when you look at, again, the challenges that we're up against and what it is that we need to be able to provide, that's a good one to, I think, sink your teeth into as well. Like you said, you gotta spend some time with it. But there's a lot of good info into that one. The last one, maybe if you're just looking for an interesting read, My Secret War by Drury. I think it's out of print right now, but it's about an A-1 Sky Raider and a lot of the missions into Vietnam out of Laos is a particularly good one. Again, when you look at agile combat employment and operating out of austere places, that's a pretty good read. And again, kind of taking off and doing things by mission type orders only is a pretty good book.
All right. I'm going to leave you with this and give you the last word. And again, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. It's been a great time talking to you. You get to see a lot of the young folks that are coming through that are honing their skills and are going to be downrange in both combat operations that we're doing now and in the future if they're called upon. My guess is getting to see kind of that leading edge. You got to be enthusiastic about what the force is continuing to produce. So sometimes I don't think we do a good enough job about saying, hey, that next generation is ready. Any thoughts on that front as to what the next generation is producing and why we should feel good that our air and space forces are going to be providing what the nation needs?
Yeah, no, they are doing amazing. When you look at it, I don't know if I could get through the weapons school today with a lot of the things that we ask them to do, whether it's the integration, the knowledge of the advanced capabilities that are out there, how best to employ that. I mean, I'm just in awe when I look at them going like the amount of knowledge that you guys have, the threats that you are looking at and the capabilities. I mean, I remember almost pulling an all-nighter getting ready for the AIM-9 test. You know, that pales in comparison to the things they're studying and the things that they're wielding. And so I got to fly a Wizent sortie yesterday and again, walked out just going like, we're in good hands. They got bloodied up and beat up and their mistakes were punished. But at the same time, their ability to work through fog and friction, to lead, to critically think, it is phenomenal. And they're doing that against very, very challenging problems. And so we've got a great trajectory. We have got a ton of good talent coming in here. And they're doing it, again, because it's not about them. And so we're in good hands. The flight path is solid. And the team is doing a phenomenal job. And that's what this place is about, no matter who's in the seat here. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much. It's pretty clear. I hope to the listeners that I am passionate about Nellis and what it does for the air and space forces of this country and for our allies and partners. And thank you for your leadership of that organization. I know it continues to surpass our expectations of what it can be. You can't even imagine where it'll be in the next 4 or 5 years, you know, when you come back, and it's just an awesome experience. So with that, thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it. Great talking to you and had a blast.
Well, that does it for my interview with 57th Wing Commander, Brigadier General Michael Johnny Bravo Drowley. I can't thank General Drowley enough for joining me and talking about Nellis Air Force Base and his wing. It's clearly in good hands. I couldn't help but get excited about Nellis. I haven't been out there since I started my squadron command in 2019, which may not seem like a long time, but I was just thinking that's the longest time I've been away from Nellis in my Air Force career, and I miss it. I want to get back to Nellis, our mecca of air power, if you will. It's exciting to hear what the wing is doing and the quality of warfighter that they're producing. I really enjoyed my conversation with General Drowley, and I really hope that you did as well. As always, the opinions expressed were those of myself and General Drowley and do not necessarily reflect the official position of the Department of Defense or the United States Air Force. I hope you all subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to leave a review, I'd appreciate that as well. You can interact with me on social media. I'm at AirMindedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, this is the Air-Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel, signing off.